Alrighty. The manic expressionist herself, Patricia Miranda.
Hello, how are you?
Absolutely. We're doing delightful. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, thanks. It's it's been pretty hectic for me in terms of like trying to get myself ready for MomoCon as the recording of this podcast. So I'm gonna be working on doing my first panel up there this coming Sunday. So I'm just trying to get myself ready for that.
Excellent. For those that don't know, it discusses all kinds of things, mainly comic book, anime, and just cartoons in general. But yeah, to get a panel there, if you don't mind me asking before we begin, how did that come about?
Other with MomoCon?
Just other than, you know, being interested. I know you've done stuff there before, but like, how did it?
Well, no, actually, this is my first MomoCon. I visited many conventions, and I've tried to actually get a panel over there. But there was one time in which I did get a panel at Florida SuperCon, which is all the way in around the Fort Lauderdale, Miami area several years ago. But they messed up my room, and in compensation, they actually just gave me a 4-day free pass. And I met up a lot of cool guests over there, and I just walked around and just enjoyed whatever the convention had. And so I tried to get a footing into conventions and doing panels, but then COVID struck. And then recent times, I tried to submit panels. I tried to do one for MomoCon last year, but they declined me. And this year, they actually accepted me. So if you're interested in checking it out, if you are in the Atlanta area, it is over by the Georgia Convention Center over at, I believe it's Jefferson Street. And from Thursday, as of tomorrow, from tomorrow to Sunday, May 28th, is going to be the major convention called MomoCon. A lot of amazing guests are going to be over there. A lot of amazing panels are going to be over there. I'm doing my panel on Sunday, May 28th at 8:30 in the morning. And it's about analytical essays in media. So that is what my panel's about.
Very sweet. How do you get encouraged to do this? Like, what really just drives your the creativity process with you? What'd you say?
Well, I guess I've always been interested in writing ever since I was very young. I've wanted to just create stories of something that I knew, something that interested me. I went through like different periods with writing stories and then writing poetry and then writing stories again and then writing scripts for plays. And recently I started doing various projects that had been taking a lot of my time. And my stuff for Old School Lame started about like 10 years ago, back in 2011. And it was around the time in which
internet exploding post 07.
Yeah, so it was basically a time in which my best friend and co-founder of Old School Lame, Kevin, and I, we were at a low point in our lives where we were unemployed. There was nothing in the job market, and we just decided to just, we were basically in our quarter midlife crisis where we just like looked back on our favorite stuff from our childhood in the 90s. And that's when we decided to start Old School Lame. We started with blogs in our first year. Then November 2012 was when we first had our taste in podcasts, where we did a topic of Nickelodeon for Old School and casual chats. And then just recently, we just posted up our 200th episode. So
200th.
Yeah.
Man. That is.
Yeah. We probably would have reached a much higher number, but I juggle between like maybe 5 or 6 different podcasts. So yeah, I mean, in addition to that, I also do Picks Mix with Aaron Mehta from The Aaron Mehta Show. We look at every single Pixar
I've heard
film
of him, but haven't read his listened to his shows, but you did tell me about the Pixar one, and that was cool because, you know, that doesn't just, again, it doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, originally when we went to see Coco together, we were like, you know, let's just talk about Pixar movies. And he came up with the idea about, let's just watch it in random order. So we found a random wheel website and we just put all the Pixar films and then we spun it. And whatever movie it landed on, that was the movie we were watching. Dream Machine, which was our follow-up, which was looking at all the DreamWorks films, we just went traditional, and we did other films where we went in the traditional route. Like, we looked at all the Roald Dahl adaptations for the Roald Dahl retrospective, and currently we are doing Journey to the Blue Sky, where we're looking at all the Blue Sky Studios films. We're at the halfway mark. We just finished watching Rio a few months ago, and now we're diving into the fourth Ice Age film, which we'll talk about sometime this summer. And then afterwards, we'll be going back into Dream Machine again, because, as you know, Ruby Gilman will be coming out this summer. And
that's right.
And then the third Trolls movie is going to be coming out around Christmas. And then as for Pix Mix, that will be Elemental. That'll be coming out this year. So, yeah, those are some things that we've been tuning into, which is it's been a lot. But you know what? It's a lot of fun talking and looking back on all these films and whatever topics that we talk about in casual chats, whether it be TV shows, video games, movies, anime. Just something that we enjoy doing. And that's something that in the 10 years of Old School Lane, I mean, that's been our goal, is to just talk about things that we love and hoping that people can be able to tune in and enjoy.
Right. what do you think just keeps you going overall, other than reintroducing this to people who, you know, were not fortunate to actually see it back when it was first huge and what have you?
You know, I think that even if you didn't see it when it first came out, it's never too late to be introduced to it. I think that for a lot of people who may have not tuned into, say, As Told by Ginger, for example, because around 2000, when that show came out on Nickelodeon, there were a lot of other Nicktoons at the time that people were tuning into, like Fairly Odd Parents or The Adventures of Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, or Chalk Zone. And there were some people who had somewhat of kind of like a restricted bias towards the show because, you know, it featured a female protagonist and it was more about going through the slice of life storytelling as opposed to like being a wacky, goofy cartoon like a lot of Nicktoons at the time. So I've had a lot of people.
Sexism was still in existence, guys, years before.
Yeah. And also, this was something that I mentioned several times in my videos and my podcast that. I don't know if you've ever had a problem with this, but there were like certain shows that you couldn't watch because of your gender. Like, you know, when I was a kid in the 80s, I wasn't allowed to watch things like He-Man or Ninja Turtles because I was a girl. And apparently those shows were for boys. So.
Lots of phobias. Even sometimes you just would get an unpleasant thing that just stayed with you, where you saw, you know, parents saying, well, because I don't like it, I don't think you should rot your brain watching it either. And it's like, well, that's my brain to rot. That's my choice, you know.
Right.
Maybe it's good and you just don't like it. But yeah, there have been plenty of those. I mean, I would see it with even Pepper Ann, and what's the one MTV cartoon,
Daria.
Yeah. And then even other dorky stuff like Doug and what have you, and people would that you would see sexism wars, I call it, where it's like, okay, that this is for everybody, there's no restriction, this isn't for a mature audience or anything. It's not, it just blows your mind when people just get in bad habits like that.
Right. But no, I've received a lot of messages from people when they saw my videos and my discussion of the episodes of As Told by Ginger when I was one of the co-hosts of the podcast We're In Between with Casey and Ashley from the Friday Night Nicktoons podcast, where we looked back on every episode of As Told by Ginger. We even had some people who were working on the show at the time and talking about what made the show so special. And people who had never seen the show or people who hadn't seen it in a very long time were very appreciative of what we were doing. So I would just say that it's never too late to get into something. And if you were a person who kind of like brought into light of something that they've never even seen before, or maybe they have heard it but never had the chance to see it, it feels really good to bring something of light to people, because I mean, there's just so much stuff out there and we tend to like miss one or two things, and it's great to discover it even if it's been long since it's premiered.
Yeah, you can only find certain copies because all the DVDs have changed the music or what have you. Yeah,
that's an example of Daria, in which there were a lot of songs that had to be changed because of copyright issues. And ridiculous. Whenever that you listen to like the songs that were featured on the DVD, it's just not the same.
No, it just can't be replicated, unfortunately, unless you have an old VHS tape that you wore out.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's so much fantasy and sci-fi worlds in some of these animations, and then there's just legit, just very clever comedy that you can watch with the whole family. Adults will get certain ones, and then certain cartoon shows we can definitely discuss too, where it just reminds you as to, you know, back when a cartoon really did kind of make a cool impression on you. It wasn't just, you know, to fill time on Saturdays.
But that's not to say that those aren't very special either. Into my experiences in conventions, I remember when I was waiting in line to meet up with Roger Bumpus, who you may know as the voice of Squidward. I was having him autograph my Invader Zim DVD because he played as Professor Membrane. And there was a guy right in front of me who was dressed up as the scout from Team Fortress 2. And he was talking to him about a story about when he was like very young, he went from like different foster homes. And he remembered that on the times that he was at his happiest was when he would run home after school and he would watch SpongeBob. And that just, you know, goes to show you about, you know, how much these shows mean a lot to you. And even if it's something that's to make you laugh, even if it's something that is to motivate you or to relate to you, anything can be of positive note. I think that, when people underestimate or undermine media, they think of it as just like a waste of time or mm-hmm. something that is not worthy compared to like you should be reading a book or
it's
you should
low be doing. Brow.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. They think of it as lowbrow, yeah. And so,
why would it exist if it didn't have a purpose? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
That's just it. We can hate something that we just, for whatever reason, we never understood. We can have a game show that's kind of tacky. We can have a reality show, which altogether is kind of offensive. But hey, if there's a bunch of people watching it, it's going to be on the air for who knows how many years. And
Right. But yeah, the point of the matter is that even if a show means like less to you compared to somebody else, it doesn't mean that it doesn't leave a slight impression on them.
Yeah, I mean, if people are talking about it, why wouldn't we believe it to be, you know?
Right, exactly.
But yeah, there's always people wanting to even kind of, not to be too political, kind of like how we see in certain schools how certain stuff is off limits for teaching, and there's other kinds of gatekeeping with certain geekdoms. We do see kind of just other people trying to act like certain stuff doesn't exist, and it's like, no, you can't. It's not how this works.
Yeah, well, I don't think I really had that issue because in 2004, when the internet was at rampant, I mean, I was already in college, so we had free access to like watching things that we were able to like get easy access on. I mean, I remember when YouTube was just starting and people were just like uploading a lot of like clips of cartoons from the 80s and 90s, or they were uploading anime, and you know, back when, you know, before that, various websites had to like get them to easily access it, like Crunchyroll. I mean, Crunchyroll didn't exist back then, so we had to like watch like really bad versions of poorly subtitled anime on BitTorrent websites. And if you wanted to be able to tune into that, I mean, you just had to, wait until maybe a few days after it came out in Japan and then just watch it. And, whenever I hear kids saying like, in our school, they limited the internet, we couldn't go into certain sites. I mean, the only thing that I had as a kid on, when we had computer classes was, we learned like basic typing, like we knew about, which side of the hand you get to type on with letters on a keyboard and hand where's the dominant. Enter button. And then as soon as we were done with that, then we just played computer games. There was a lot of edutainment games that we had, like Oregon Trail or Midnight Rescue or Carmen Sandiego or something like that. So, yeah, whenever I hear kids thinking about that, it's like, oh, man, you know, like school has drastically changed from when I was a kid.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's gonna listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Brent Pope, the host of Breakfast with Brent Pope. You've seen me on some of your favorite TV shows saying things like, give it up, Jimmy. You got to sink this putt to win. On Breakfast with Brent Pope, I sit down with guests from the entertainment world and we do it all over breakfast. Or should I say Breakfast? Every week on Breakfast, you get inside Hollywood info and tips, great breakfast wrecks and booty debates. Most of all, you get the most delightful 30 minutes of your week. So dig in. It's breakfast time. Listen at breakfast.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsy, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
It's just crazy to think about.
And here we are. Got to keep having these conversations just to remind people, hey, you know, just don't actually question life. Actually have a heart-to-heart chat with yourself and your loved ones and get comfortable with yourself. And then, I mean, yes, there's so many ways to learn different things. Do you remember when there was interactive CDs that you would actually interact with? But that seems to be a lost art. Everyone has kind of gone back to gaming.
I guess it depends. I mean, I think that interactivity, it definitely has moved a little bit towards online, but I do see some people like interacting with one another. I guess it depends on where you're located at, and I guess it depends on, you know, what the meetup is. So I still like to think that physical activity is still around.
I would hope. But yeah, I mean, there's so many other cartoons that have still just left an intriguing, just kind of nostalgia with us, because they are kind of almost like a Jim Henson way where they're trying to actually kind of have us learn stuff while we're interacting with it.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of stuff out there that you can be able to learn that we definitely didn't learn when we were kids. Like, I remember when, Sailor Moon was out, and the whole concept of Sailor Neptune and Sailor Uranus being cousins and all, I didn't know until like a little later on that it's like, no, they were actually a gay couple. But nowadays, you know, we have like a lot of representation of the LGBTQ. We have like, Legend of Korra, The Loud House, The Owl House, Amphibia, She-Ra and the Princesses of Power. That's one example of something that, you know, we didn't have as kids, but today's kids have. Also different cultures. Like, seriously, I mean, you know, you had like, you know, you ever had like the, you know, you ever seen those in those shows, like you have like the groups of friends and, you know, like, you know, one of them is like, you know, the African-American kid and the other one is like, you know, the Jewish kid and the other one is the Spanish kid. And, you know, there was like a little sprinkles of other ethnicities here and there.
Culture. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But nowadays, I mean, I've seen a lot more cultures represented than I've ever seen. I mean, there's Filipinos, there's Thai, there's different flavors of, you know, the Spanish community, a lot of different flavors of the Asian community, just things that, again, I've never seen. I've never seen all these cultures properly represented. And, you know, also casted represent, you know, authentically and with proper representation too, which I thought that was fantastic to see. And I'm really glad that, again, today's kids are able to get a taste of that.
Totally.
Yeah. So I guess another thing that, you know, we want to talk about, I guess, you know, the reason why you brought me here is to talk about animated films.
Right. As well as one. We're mainly highlighting the ones that just not just changed our lives, but just really felt culturally relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think what would be a good example. Well, one of my favorites that I've seen, like it was over a decade ago that I remember seeing this and I was just like blown away by it, was a 2009 stop motion film. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's called Mary and Max. Are you familiar with it?
Mary and Max. I can't say I am. 2009?
Yes, 2009.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's an Australian stop motion film.
I see it now. Wow.
Yeah, it's a great film, by the way. It's about an 8-year-old girl who is very lonely and she's constantly isolated by her family and teased by her classmates. And she starts writing to a pen pal. And it turns out that this pen pal is all the way in New York City. And he's this like middle-aged overweight guy who has Asperger's syndrome. And they start developing a friendship with one another, writing each other letters over the years. And we get to see Mary grow up and connecting with Max and wanting to learn more about Asperger's syndrome and, you know, trying to find a way to cure it. And then Max was like really disappointed. It's like, no, I mean, even though that I struggle with my condition, I want to be able to, you know, be proud of it and not be ashamed of it. So it's based off of a true story, actually. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you check it out. It's on Tubi for absolutely free. It's one of the best animated films that you would ever see in terms of like being very melodramatic, very real, and just beautifully detailed with this animation. I mean, stop motion is one of my favorite forms of craft with animation. You know, I like Laika, and I also do like a lot of Aardman animation, but whenever I see stop motion that's not done by those guys and they're able to tell a really unique story with it, that's when I really gravitate myself towards it.
Totally. I've always been familiar with it from Rankin Bass to Wallace and Gromit, but yeah. It's very interesting just seeing just how it keeps changing altogether.
Absolutely. You know, the times have definitely made things somewhat easier for crafting animation. I mean, stop motion is still just as time consuming. I mean, you're able to like dedicate like 8 hours every single day just to have like 3 minutes of animation going. But once you see the behind the scenes work of how they're able to make that done, it's really impressive. I mean, that's why in every single Laika film, you get to see like a major scene that they put in so much work into come to life. And that's what's really impressive.
1,000%.
Yeah. So yeah, tell me a film that means a lot to you.
You know, it's a like it or hate it, but I definitely recommend the rotoscoped 70s Lord of the Rings movie.
Oh, okay. The one with Ralph Bakshi.
Yes.
Okay.
Just it's a like it or hate it, but it's kind of one of those where the style kind of just stands out a little more and the voice acting is pretty solid, but also just despite being grim, I mean, there's no way to tell Lord of the Rings without being grim, but I just mean it's interesting how you can probably watch it easily with someone of an earlier generation as well as with today's generation seeing what they think. And out of all the earlier cartoons, this one probably rings truth because even though it kind of ends abruptly, it's still, it's just very ambitious and you kind of applaud them for trying any kind of version of this.
Yeah. I think that they were going to do Return of the King next, but I think there was like some complications with the production. And so eventually Rankin Bass did it.
Totally. They pretty much the rights reverted when they didn't make use of the contract, but it made both Time Out and the Online Film Critics Society of Best Animated Films. So I thought I'd bring that up because while it was kind of in and out and long forgotten, it's had a solid cult fan base. And if I'm going to give any applause to any animated movie for their ambitiousness, it'd probably be that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked about something similar during Fantasy Month and In Search of the Crystal Skull. That's another podcast that my co-host Aaron Mehta from The Aaron Mehta Show and I do, where we look at films in the 60% to 79% range on Rotten Tomatoes. And during Fantasy Month, our first film that we saw was Rankin Bass's The Hobbit. It was the first attempt of trying to adapt anything like that. This was
made for TV.
Made for TV. And yeah, it's definitely a more truncated, more shorter and more straightforward adaptation of The Hobbit.
I saw it in school.
Yeah. I remember I saw it when I was about 7 or 8 years old when Cartoon Network had Mr. Spim's Cartoon Theater and they would have like these showcases of old films the 70s. Yeah.
Great block. They even would show Return of the King on a lazy Sunday every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They show and Flight of the Dragons and Twice Upon a Time. Gulliver's Travels, lots of really obscure
even
films.
Don Bluth stuff like Five Ghost Westerns.
Yeah. Even though that wasn't Don Bluth, Steven Spielberg did that. Don Bluth did the original American Tale, but yeah, he never did Five Ghost West. I think when Five Ghost West was out, I think that Don Bluth was producing Rockadoodle or Anastasia or something.
Oh, gotcha. So he jumped the ambulance ship and they
He jumped the ambulance ship, yeah.
But no, he has some interesting stuff, too. It's interesting how everyone has gone back and forth on both Taika Waititi as well as Disney's answer to that, Treasure Planet, too. And
yeah.
Even some of the other post-90s ones, which kind of scratch your head because you saw the VHS trailer, so you figured, hey, you know, it was a big smash hit. And then surprisingly, some of these weren't too kind financially or critic-wise, but they've been kind of... they're just as much as part of the Disney machine as some of their earlier materials. So it's.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that box office numbers and sometimes even mixed reactions from professional film critics does not dictate on how media is going to be as a whole. It just goes to show you that even films that were considered to be massive flops at the time are now just as influential to media as anything. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life was a box office bomb when it first Wizard of Oz, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And now those are just as beloved as anything. And yeah, it's kind of funny that you mentioned about that time period when, you know, they were trying to do animated sci-fi films and it just didn't exactly click with audiences, you know, like Atlantis, Treasure Planet, Titan A.E. It just was kind of like that awkward period where they were seeing that the audience was growing older and mature and they try to deviate from what they were doing and try to do something a little bit different. And it felt kind of off-putting, but you couldn't say that they didn't try.
Yeah. And it's even kind of wackier how some of these companies have merged with the other, you know, Pixar merged with Disney, Fox is now Disney after Don Bluth tried to escape there. And some of these people who we've had grown up admiring Hab. Unfortunately, had some scandals, but still do conventions, still just really did so much for animated crowds. And I think we're kind of getting to that point where we're actually also trying to understand storytelling better through animated lenses, because mm-hmm. so many people reference it, but we don't really always know why they responded to it a certain way. You know, is it how the joke telling tells the story better? Is it how just storyboarded it is that it just really just it just leaves you just feeling just so giddy after the fact? And you're just like, man, that was an experience unlike any other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that presentation is definitely key, but also at the same time, you know, how the story is and how the characters are. And when all of those combine into one, then it becomes a great experience. I think that, you know, even sometimes if something is lacking, as long as the other makes up for it, then it'll become an experience in its own right. Like, for example, if you want to go into like, oh, you know, the animation wasn't that great, but the story and the characters were great. Like Rocky and Bullwinkle, for example, back in the 50s and 60s, in which, you know, they, you know, were working pretty limited. They had almost like no money to work with, and they were animating on in a studio in Mexico. But at the same time, you know, what made up for it was the clever writing and the characters and the voice actors who were able to make it like if it was done on a radio show back in the 40s. And so they were able to stay within infamy because of the writing and the characters. And then there's also the fact that we go another direction where sometimes the animation is fantastic, but maybe the story and the characters are not that great. I mean, let's just say Gay Paris from the 60s, where Chuck Jones and his wife Dorothy had left Warner Brothers briefly and went over to UPA and wrote and directed this movie that had beautiful animation. And it had, you know, music written by the same people who wrote The Wizard of Oz. And it was Judy Garland in one of her last movies right before she died. I mean, the animation is gorgeous, by the way. I mean, it's UPA. You know,
I know Chuck Jones, but I'm actually not familiar with this one. That's wild.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not a great movie, unfortunately. It's kind of slow paced. I mean, I even said this when I did my podcast with my friend Chris, aka Rowdy Seymour from TV Trash, where we looked back on the bronze. Name. Yeah, when we looked back on the bronze and the silver and bronze age Disney films from the 60s and 70s, where a lot of the movies at the time were pretty slow paced.
Yeah.
And Gay Paris was kind of no exception. It was very slow paced. And a lot of the people from UPA were trying to like follow the Disney formula about like including all of these songs. It's like, hey, we got Judy Garland. Hey, we got the same songwriters as Wizard of Oz. Let's just put a whole bunch of music in there. But the music is nice, but it doesn't flow with the story. I think they were just trying to add in music is because, oh, well, Disney, you know, does music with their movies. Let's see if we can do the same thing.
Is it kind of like Phantom Tollbooth or some of those?
Yes, yeah, exactly. That was the movie that Chuck Jones did after Gay Paris. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So this was like after, when Warner Brothers found out what Chuck Jones did and they fired him. And so he became a freelancer. He did, he did Phantom Tollbooth, and then, you know, he worked with Dr. Seuss and animated all the Dr. Seuss adaptations. So yeah, that's exactly what happened. But yeah, I, again, depending on what craft you're focusing on, it can be really good. Like it could be really influential and really breathtaking. Yeah. But you want to have hopefully the entire package working for it. Like you know, you could have like great characters and great story, but if the animation is lacking, you know, sometimes it could be a little bit of a downfall or distracting, or sometimes you can overlook it. Same thing with, you know, art style. You know, if the art style and animation is breathtaking, but the story and characters are just kind of lackluster, again, you could either, you know, find it distracting or you can overlook it. As for me, I'm one of those people who kind of like tries to be a little bit of both, but I am kind of distracted when there's an imbalance between one or the other.
Fair enough. I actually, not to be contrarian, I actually thought Rocky and Bullwinkle was actually by Hanna-Barbera. It just looked very familiar to me years ago, and it's about the fifth time this year where I've actually had to remind myself, no, that was never a thing. But
yeah, that's Jay Ward Productions. But Jay I don't blame you for thinking that, because I mean, when you think about Hanna-Barbera, they were like the dominating force of animation during like that time period from the 60s all the way up until arguably maybe like the 70s and the early 80s. And then when you had like Filmation come along, and then when you had Ralph Bakshi have his production studio when they were doing the Mighty Mouse cartoon. I mean, yeah, you basically had Hanna-Barbera doing all of their shows. And, you know, that's where we got a lot of programs, and you know, a lot of them were kind of just copycats of things that they've done in the past. But for a lot of people, that was all they had. And then, you know, going into movies, you know, Hanna-Barbera back in the 80s did the Superstars 10, where they had like, you know, Hey There, It's Yogi Bear. They had like the Flintstones Meet the Jetsons. They had the three Scooby-Doo.
So much crossover.
There was a crossover. Yeah. There was this the three Scooby-Doo movies, where it was Scooby-Doo meets the Boo Brothers, Scooby-Doo meets the Ghoul School, and then Scooby-Doo and the Reluctant Werewolf. So
yeah, I saw those a bunch, but for whatever reason, the laugh track in those were kind of always felt last minute to me compared to the main show.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why they put in the laugh track at the time. I mean, you know, they were trying to essentially do an animated sitcom.
And with the
And at the time, you know, laugh tracks were there in sitcoms. They were there in I Love Lucy. They were there in Dick Van Dyke. Again, Honeymooners, which, you know, debatably got a lot of their inspiration from the Flintstones. So that's why laugh tracks were there. And I think that, you know, when they differentiated between like, oh, this is a cartoon, let's just remove the laugh tracks, I don't think we need it anymore, I think they kind of got that notion.
It gets weirder on later Flintstone movie specials where you're just like, should be laughing any minute now.
Exactly. Yeah, when you see like A Man Called Flintstone, or I Yabba Dabba Doo, or Holly Rockabye Baby, it's like, oh, where's the laugh track? Oh, there's no laugh track. Okay, cool.
Are you a fan by any chance of I saw this was added on a bunch of different ones. Are you down with the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie?
Oh, yeah, I would say some of the Looney Tunes movies. You know, there are some that are, it's kind of funny, because I know that a lot of them were just basically like compilations of like shorts that they try to make into a movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, I feel that, you know, something like, you know, Looney Tunes, if it can be like made into like a full length feature, I think that the core of it is just the characters, you know, acting crazy. I mean, I don't really think of it as like something that involves with like a deep storyline. I think that, you know, something like Looney Tunes doesn't really need to have a full length movie to be enjoyable. I mean, it's enjoyable as it is, as like, you know, just them, you know, going into crazy situations and just making whatever humorous moments that they can be able to, you know, pull out in either 7, 11, or 24 minutes. So full length, on the other hand, I mean, you really have to be consistent with the humor in order for that to happen.
Yeah.
I don't think I really seen too much of that. I mean, even I know a lot of people like grew up with, you know, things like Space Jam. It's actually funny, because I remember when I saw Space Jam in theaters, and the first thing that I saw when I was waiting in line was just people outside literally selling merchandise. So even before I saw the movie, there was already people selling merchandise outside, like the jerseys and the toys and the secret stuff, which was literally just a bottle of water. So, I mean, already I knew from the moment that I was waiting in line, I knew this was just definitely a promotional push. So, yeah, I wasn't like fooled into it, you know. So even when I saw the final product, yeah, I just wasn't really crazy about it. And I have not seen Space Jam: A New Legacy either. I was definitely not interested in tuning into it. So I'm sure at some point I'll have to watch it. But in the meanwhile, I have stayed away from it. And I have not seen Looney Tunes Back in Action either, even though I've heard some people said it was pretty okay.
I saw it in the theaters, but it didn't have anything on the original Space Jam for me. But the sequel is like it or hate it. It's gonna either be fun, or you're just gonna be like, just not feeling it.
We're getting too old. Fair enough. Sounds like I'm not missing much.
Yeah. I just thought it was fun that they just implied we're kind of making fun of cinematic universes. They're like, hey, we're the Warner Brothers universe is a whole thing. They're all in the audience.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, there always seems to be a case in which, you know, whatever is going on at the time, they have to make fun of it. And it would be a really great concept because, you know, Looney Tunes has always made homages or has poked fun at whatever was out so at the much. Time. And I would think, hey, if done correctly, this would have been brilliant because they could have, you know, made fun of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or everything needs to be connected. Everything needs to be a franchise film or something. And again, if they would have done something like that, like poke fun of it, I think that that would have been brilliant. But then again, like I said, I've not seen the movie, so I don't know if maybe they went into that direction. I could be completely spoiling myself.
They totally go there, but it's, again, it's a like it or hate it. Like, you're either going to find it too much or you're going to find, yeah, I can watch this with kids. It's okay. But,
okay, then. All right, that's fine.
But who knows? You might find it tacky. You might find it annoying. I can't say. Everyone varies on that movie. I just was like, hey, this is not a 4 out of 10 star movie for me. I wasn't bored, but
yeah.
It also wasn't brilliant. It would never make a top 10 animated list ever.
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny because, you know, I feel really bad for like Warner Brothers because I knew like for a long time they tried to, you know, release theatrical movies, but unfortunately, like most of them were bombs. I just finished recording an episode of my podcast that's literally coming up on Memorial Day. It was myself, Diva from Musical Hell and that long hair creepy guy. And we talked about Quest for Camelot.
Yes. One of my sister's favorites.
Yeah, so... You know, it's you know, when you hear about the behind the scenes stories about, you know, how much of a disaster the making of that movie was and how the people who are working on that film were just like really frustrated that all the executives wanted to do was just make it into Disney when the original source material was supposed to be darker.
Yeah.
And then when the final product came out, the audiences and the critics were not fooled and it became a box office failure. I mean, you should have seen like the promotional push that they try to do to it. Like,
I remember every other VHS is like had to have an ad for that or some other Warner Brothers film that had a Disney approach. And it was just like, okay, that's a big voice cast, but
yeah, exactly.
I would get it mixed up. You'll find this funny. The Road to El Dorado, the DreamWorks movie.
Oh, interesting.
Because the same almost exact style, just 2D. And, you know, there's no mistaking Prince of Egypt because that's a biblical but that one for whatever reason just had certain, even though it was taking on just Arthurian legends and other stuff, it just looks similar to me even though it's a totally different time period. Just
yeah, we're talking about like maybe 400 years.
Oh yeah, totally.
And we're talking about like, you know, instead of taking place in England, it takes place in Spain then going all the way into like Central America.
Totally.
Yeah, but I can see where you're coming from. It kind of has like that same humor and that
Indiana
same...
Indiana Jones for kids.
Yeah, exactly. Indiana Jones for kids. Yeah.
Indiana Jones already is kind of for kids, but I just mean like you can watch it with a G-rated crowd without worrying, okay, this might be a little too intense.
Gotcha.
Let's wait 5 birthdays from now.
Yeah, you're not going to get any like ripping hearts or melting faces or anything like that.
Jones, you son of a bitch. Yeah, it's nothing like that.
No, definitely not.
But do you have any favorite anime also? Because I mean, we have so many others, like the same team that worked on Akira later worked on Ghost in the Shell and
Steam Boy. Actually funny that you mentioned Ghost in the Shell because when I was it was before COVID hit. I remember this. It was March 2020. I was in Florida for spring break. This was like around my sophomore year in college, like going back to college. You know, I went to college from 2004 to 2008, and then after 15 years
of the curve,
like,
man.
Yeah, and then after like working like over a decade in, you know, odd jobs because the, you know, basically like the job market sucked and the place that I was at, I was not in a good place. So I decided to go back to school. And so My sophomore year, on my second time in college, I went to the Morikami Museum, which is located in Florida, the South Florida to be specific. By the way, it is a great Japanese museum and gardens place. I would recommend that if you are into that, please go there. And when Aaron and I were there, there was an entire exhibit dedicated to Ghost in the Shell.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, there was like animation cells. There was animatic to final product.
Was this before they did the 3D remaster? I never saw it, but I heard about it.
I think it was. Okay. I think they might have been promoting that, actually.
Sweet.
Yeah, I think this was like maybe, I would say it was like maybe a year after the live action version came out, the one with Scarlett Johansson.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think that maybe it was kind of like, oh, you know, this live action movie's out. Maybe it was kind of like to, you know, see where the original source material came from anyway. So, yeah, I loved Ghost in the Shell when it first came out. Akira was a fantastic movie. It was definitely leaning more towards like the
steampunk.
Yeah, Tetsuo, yes.
Dragon Ball Z. There's a convoluted story. You miss an episode, you're lost. You're like, what's going on? You got all these almighty gods. But they want the world while another one wants to free the world of this tyrant. And yeah, it's all kinds of serialized.
Yeah. And I guess I wouldn't be, you know, an anime fan without talking about something from Studio Ghibli. Like I remember when I was a kid and I remember like the early dubs of, you know, Kiki's Delivery Service and Castle in the Sky right before Disney came along and did the dubs for it. And I remember when Spirited Away came out when I was in college. No, I was in high school. It was 2001. Yeah, I was in high school. And I remember when everybody was into Spirited Away. And I remember that there was like a massive push for all of the Studio Ghibli films because Hayao Miyazaki was good friends with John Lasseter at the time. And so, you know, there was a lot more push with the dubs. And that's when we got to see like newer takes on the dubs from. Oh yeah, that's literally how we got them in the first place.
I thought it was some other guys there, but that's wild.
Yeah, I know. It's true that's how we got the newer dubs of the Studio Ghibli films in the first place was because Hayao Miyazaki was good friends with John Lasseter.
Wow, small world.
That's the thing. You know, as somebody who, you know, has had, you know, experiences with helping with media projects. It's kind of hard to believe for those who haven't had the experience, but you know, the media industry, the entertainment industry is smaller than you think because everybody knows somebody from another studio or from another company or something like that. Like, you know, somebody from ABC would know somebody from NBC and vice versa. You know, they're good, you know, they're good colleagues with one another. They've worked together on various projects and, you know, you want to be able to keep yourself, you know, a good float and, you know, work hard and showcase that you're able to learn from everything that you've been taught and just go out there and do the best that you can. And trust me, if you do not, they will report back to the other company if, you know, let's just say that you are let go. They will hear about
you. They're gone.
Yeah, you're gone. Yeah. They will say, okay, well, I know that you didn't do good with this company. Well, I mean, we don't want to work with you. So say, trust me, it's a small world out there. You know, just do your best with whatever work that you're given.
Totally.
Yeah, so yeah, Studio Ghibli. I loved you know, films such as Kiki's Delivery Service, Nausicaa the Valley of the Wind, Castle in the Sky, Princess Mononoke. I really do enjoy Spirited Away. It's like in my top three, but I don't like hold it above a pedestal like a lot of other people do. I also really enjoyed Howl's Moving Castle.
There you go.
Yeah, I really love that. I haven't seen, you know, like the newer, you know, films from Studio Ghibli. I haven't seen Pompoko. I haven't seen Pompoko. I haven't seen My Neighbor the Yamadas. I haven't seen Earwig and the Witch. I've been hearing about that, but I haven't seen it. And from what I understand, that the next Studio Ghibli project is going to be Miyazaki's last film, quote unquote last film, because he said that like four or five times. That the last film he's doing is going to be his retirement film. He said that ever since Princess Mononoke. You know, it's like, oh, you know, whatever reason he decides to come back and do one more film. Okay, you know, I'm done with that. I'm going to be retiring after I'm done with Princess Mononoke. Oh, I got to do Spirited Away. Okay, I'm done with that. I'm going to retire. Oh, I'm going to do Howl's Moving Castle. Okay, I'm done. Oh, here comes Ponyo. Oh, here comes The Wind Rises. So yeah, even though that Miyazaki says that this is going to be his last film, and he says it was going to be dedicated to his grandson, we know that there's probably going to be something up his sleeve that he's going to be working on. I mean, at least I'm hoping so, because, I mean, you know, even though that Hayao has his, you know, interesting takes on what he feels about certain things, like, I know he doesn't like 3D animation, and I know that there are some, you know, bits of storytelling that he kind of finds a little bit meandering, but, I mean, yep. The man's a genius at the end.
Absolutely. There's no way anyone's going to just absolutely hate him unless they, for whatever reason, are like some of the gatekeepers you described at the beginning, where there's like, cartoons are for stupid people. It's like, well, speak for yourself. Well,
I would say that that's kind of like more of a North American thing, because
I countries guess, or a boomer thing.
I guess so. I mean, I would say that
I don't complain at you if you want to watch your game shows or your doctor or cop shows, but leave people to their devices. God's sakes, can all be enjoyed.
Yeah. I mean, this is more of a North American thing, to be quite honest, because again, Japan has always been on the stance of, you know, what is this you know, when we're doing anime or when we're doing
totally
like
pro
a film.
Animation, especially as your mind. When given how Hanna-Barbera relocated to South Korea for when they had all those animated Scooby-Doo movies.
Right. But yeah, I mean, they basically, whenever they did their projects, they kept in mind that this is for a general audience. I mean, if something is for kids, then they'll do it for kids. But at the same time, they want to, you know, add in some things that the adults can get into. Same thing with other European countries like France. Like, as I mentioned before, yeah, France is big when it comes to animated films for all audiences. like, if you look at some of the films that they have, like Triplets of Belleville or Ernest and Celestine or Leap or Persepolis, like a lot of the stuff that they have is for all audiences. And some of it is like pretty dark. And again, it's leaning more towards the all audience stance that, you know, hey, you know, we're not just doing this for like little kids just because it's animated. I mean, we're, you know, generating this for everybody. Everybody can be able to enjoy it. And if you're not ready to watch it yet, then, you know, you have to be at the right age for it. But that's not to say that there's nothing that you can gravitate towards. I mean, unless, of course, if it's violent or anything like that, then of course, stay away from that. But if it's like sophisticated, like again, Triplets of Belleville, like if a little kid were to watch it, it'll be like kind of confused with it, because it's like, okay, you have this guy who wants to be a biker who is training for the Tour de France. He gets kidnapped by the French mafia. It's up to his grandmother and his dog to rescue him so that he can be able to be, you know, not killed off by the French mafia, who are doing these underground Tour de France simulation bike races. And we need to have these three old women who are apart once upon a time in, in a stage
century,
show.
But
stage show. They used to do like a lot of stage performances in their youth.
But yeah, it's either going to be a fever dream or it's like you say, it's going to take a minute. A kid might need a parent to help.
Yeah,
explain
exactly.
It
they need to have like explanation on what am I watching? But if you watch it as an adult and you kind of have an idea on what you're watching, then it becomes really sophisticated. So it depends, you know, I think that for, you know, anything that can be able to be really engaging as both a kid and an adult, those are the things that really stand out.
It's the ones that stay with us. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you might even have some other relatives who are also really into cartoons.
Yeah.
It's weird how it can be a mixture of everything. They'll watch a hit sci-fi or drama show, then they'll watch an art house movie, then they'll watch a classic 70s concert, and then they come into these. So it is interesting for anyone who has any family member who's wants to show you their record collection as well as their movie finds. Don't ever turn them down, please.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's like the old saying goes, what's old is new again. It's kind of funny that I'm, you know, going out shopping and I see you know, vinyl records again, and people are buying them.
Unheard of, man.
It's like, I mean, who would have thought that, like, 15 years ago when everybody was, like, purchasing iPods and it's like, oh, you know, we don't need physical media anymore. Nope. You know, we can be able to just download things on our Apple stores. It's like, okay, well, meanwhile, we have physical media out there. You have vinyl records. You have the actual record players. I mean, I just literally, like, 2 years ago, if for those who are interested, I also do unboxing videos from time to time. One of the things that I had purchased were the Hey Arnold Volume 1 soundtrack on a vinyl record.
How did that sound? I
believe it sounds awesome, by the way. If you play it on a record player, it sounds really good. Like, the quality of it is excellent. And also, if you're a fan of The Adventures of Pete and Pete, for a while, they actually had their entire soundtrack released on a vinyl record. And that also sounds really great. So, yeah, vinyl records give that that audio quality that, you know, is pretty great if you're listening to it. And I think that the fact that there's, like, shows that are being released on vinyl records, even movies that are released on vinyl records, like... I'm not even joking. Yeah, Moana is released on a vinyl record. Frozen is released on a vinyl record. Yes. Zootopia is released on a vinyl record.
The Zootopia one, I was fortunate enough to see, like, I think it was shown at an art show.
Mm.
Believe it or not. And I was like, oh, what is this? Oh, my God. Oh, we're having some crossover with other different kinds of medium in art. And I was just like, man. But yeah, to have vinyl be for recent stuff is... That is saying something.
Yeah, I think I saw Soul and Luca being released on vinyl, which is actually pretty crazy. And you know, even shows like Steven Universe and Adventure Time are released on vinyl records. And you would think, vinyl? Really? But no, people are still into that stuff. Like I said, what's old is new again. And even with, like, introducing young kids to, like, old shows and movies that you grew up with. I mean, if it's going to... be just as great as it was when you first saw it, then high chances are that they'll be able to enjoy it too.
Totally.
Yeah, I there was something that we that Aaron and I talked about when we were doing Pixmix, and we were talking about, like, the Toy Story films, and we were saying, like, you know, when you see the original Toy Story, you know, Andy is, like, a young kid, and then when you see Toy Story 3, he's going off to college. I'm sure that, you know, for a generation of kids, they grew up with Andy, you know, going over from, you know, when they first saw it in 1995 to 2010. And that's like over 15 years. And then when we talked about from Toy Story 3 to Toy Story 4, that was a 9-year jump. And so I'm sure that people who saw Toy Story 3 as their first film, they probably saw the progression from where they saw, you know, Buzz and the gang, and, you know, they saw Bonnie as, like, the new owner. And now that, you know, you have the continuation of the story with, like, all the Toy Story tunes, like Partysaurus Rex and Small Fry and, you know, Barbie and Ken's Hawaiian Vacation, and following all the way up until eventually Toy Story 4, there's a generation of kids who grew up with watching a lot of the adventures with Woody and the gang as Bonnie's toys. So, you know, again, that goes to show you about how big that generational jump is. It's like,
so big.
It is big. It is massive. Like, you know, usually a generation, depending on, you know, which generation it is, it lasts for maybe about, like, maybe 10 to 15 years or maybe even 20. And a lot of things change with each generation. But one of the few things that remain the same is that if you introduce somebody of, you know, something that you grew up with, and you can be able to grow alongside with them, it's, you know, something that you take with you. It never stops.
Yeah, it's never going away, guys. Sorry.
No, it's like with Pokemon. I mean, Pokemon's been around since 1996 in Japan and then 98 in North America.
Did you ever hunt down the R-rated versions of those?
Oh, geez. But no, I mean, like, you know, you have over 1,000 episodes, you have over 20 movies, and, you know, that thing is, you know, carrying on each generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, with all the games and stuff. Yeah, exactly. And
rivalries were always a thing. And I love how you did point out, you know, contracts, all these great animation minds who just, you know, it's like studios back when, sorry, kids, this was an actual thing, back when they were mobster-owned before the feds cracked down and started unions and everything. It was interesting seeing how so many animators who were basically working for 70s equivalent of peanuts, you know, worked so hard and had a work that they were really proud of. And then, yeah, I mean, but there was always a rivalry. And but before, like you say, Warner Brothers tried to imitate Disney, before Pixar was squaring off with Disney and threatening to, you know, boycott them if they, you know, didn't like their contracts or what have you. It's, and, you know, Blue Sky was really mind blowing to me, because I was like, whoa, they're working for Fox. And now Sony's getting in on it. And now some of these other ones that like the Book of Life and all these other things that are even based in parts of Austin and Dallas is like, I think even the Jimmy Neutron studio is also there too, like you say. And it's like, they're all got their own identity. And it's even funnier when you see comedians like Christian Schaal or Jack Black who work for all of them. And it's like, yeah, they all have a Pixar or Blue Sky or Sony credit to their name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It just goes to show you about even that there's so much animation studios out there and they're crafting something different. Like, they're able to bring something unique to the table. Like, Disney so has the appeal with the different styles of animation and the story-driven characters and the way that they're able to incorporate their music. DreamWorks is able to have, like, their own style of 3D animation. And at the same time, it depends on, you know, what kind of style of storytelling they're doing, whether it be more comedic or action-packed or serious. Pixar, they're always utilizing emotions and they're utilizing, like, the storytelling approach of like, we're doing this for kids and adults. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, everybody has their own distinct style, and whether you prefer one or the other, it you know, that's great that there's a lot of variety out there. And of course, I'm sure that there's a lot of times in which, you know, there will be companies that will try to write off of it. I mean, that's not too surprising. I mean, we've seen our fair share of, like,
Eisner and some of these other guys. You're like, seriously, dude, why do you work here if you don't take pride in your work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. So
we want more of this, but we don't want it to be direct to video.
Yeah. I mean, again, going back into the whole, approach of like Disney, where they were seeing that 2D animation was kind of like going out of style, and when Pixar and DreamWorks were pretty much dominating animated films, and I guess Disney's approach was like, yeah, let's just do a lot of these direct-to-video movies. And then John Lasseter was saying like, nope, no more, we're not going to do any more direct-to-video movies. And so after Ariel's Beginning, then the studio was working on the Planes movies and then the Tinkerbell movies right before he shut down that studio entirely.
Man.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the plane scandal. That's wild.
Yeah, well, just was to show you that even something that's lighthearted doesn't always mean that it's going to be lighthearted working on it. Yeah, behind the scenes, yeah. But I think that's what's interesting is that even with like going in behind the scenes stuff, it's like, you know, you can definitely tell like a period of an animation studio when they're going through their best and when they're going through their worst. Like, you know, going again with my friend Chris, where we talked about like the different eras of Disney, like fans divide the eras of Disney into seven, because it's like, oh, this is what happened. Like, yeah. You know, we have like when Disney first started, but then World War II broke out. Oh, and now Disney is back on track, but then Walt Disney died. And then, this is a period where the nine old men were about to retire and, you know, have that mentality about like, what would Walt do? And then they did retire. And then the new people took over, like Don Bluth and Tim Burton and Richard Rich. And then, oh, we have the Renaissance period where we have Alan Menken and Howard Ashman and Glenn Keane and various other people taking over. And then, you know, oh, well, you know, here comes competition. Here comes DreamWorks. Here comes Pixar. 2D animation is dead. Let's go over to 3D next. We're back on track. Oh, we have to put all of our stuff on streaming because of COVID. So, yeah, even with like DreamWorks, they go through their period. It's like, okay, you know, we're starting things off. We have Ants, it's our first 3D movie. Then we have the 2D stuff. Shrek became a massive hit. All of the 2D movies underperformed. Going back to Shrek again and going back to the 3D again and making everything funny. Oh, you know, now we're setting a standard. And now everybody's trying to copy off of us. Oh, look, that Disney, you know, that Disney rivalry studio where they're doing something called Chicken Little, I think. And, you know, and Disney's doing some movie called The Wild to cap off on Madagascar.
I was actually a huge fan of that one, but timing, man. Timing.
Yeah, it is. It is timing.
And the plot isn't anything like it, but it was just one of those kind of like Zootopia. They just hired outside help and then blended Disney distributes it. And you're just like, for real? Why did you? It just, why people want to even just throw movies away and not make any kind of profit just blows your mind.
I couldn't tell you, awful, you know what they were.
I want my money back.
Exactly.
Because yeah. I'm even worse and when I got to distribute it on home video and explain, hey, that movie no one saw. Come watch it.
Yeah, and there's not going to be a lot of advertising for it. We're going to post it up on a promotional piece. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, and then, of course, you know, DreamWorks had their, you know, hit around 2014 when Rise of the Guardians underperformed. Then a lot of people were fired, and then they had to restructure their company again. And then Jeffrey Katzenberg left to do Quibi, and then that turned out to be a dumpster fire. And then they were purchased by...
Thinking?
I have no idea.
So many good ideas, but it was just like, so you made all these movies that are divided into five parts. Why not just, I don't know, make an original movie and... But you didn't have to create your own network.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the whole, you know, buyout with Universal and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that
Universal,
thing.
Universal, baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Pixar, you know, we have.
Oh, wait,
you
there's
know,
more.
Them, yeah. I mean, where do we start with Pixar? Like, you know, going over from, okay, you know, we're off to a great start with, you know, producing 3D animated films and. You know, then we have, you know, then we have Cars, and then afterwards we're going back on track with things. And then after Toy Story 3, then things got a little bit rocky. And then the whole John Lasseter controversy. Then he was fired.
Yeah.
Then there was a lot of change in management, and then a lot of the stuff again was put on streaming due to COVID. So yeah, there's every studio has its ups and downs. But that doesn't mean that, you know, nothing good can come from them.
Correct. And we got to remind people, hey, you know, half the time we didn't know about this, or we thought it was just people being, you know, jerks in the meeting room, or, you know, we thought they were, you know, simple disagreements, but truth be told, that's just not how it works. But at the same time, yeah, you shouldn't let, I mean, unless somebody has done something that really challenges your beliefs, you shouldn't just deny yourself watching a cool movie.
Mm-hmm.
But
absolutely,
easier said than done. I get it.
Yeah, it's very true.
Sometimes it's just,
yeah,
it's not impossible. You're just like, hey, you know, 20 years ago, I considered this person a person. Now they've done something just really jerkish in real life, and I just can't disassociate them from the movie. But yeah, with the filmmaker, it's not like we see their face everywhere we go. But at the same time, I get it.
Yeah, I understand for some people who cannot separate the art from the artist. But as for me, if that person was highly a part of it, it is difficult. But if they were just like minorly a part of it, I would just say that, you know, anything like you see on TV or you see on the screen, it's done by more than one person. It's a collaboration. Correct. A lot of people were involved with it. I would say that, yes, it's true that maybe that person that did something horrible, maybe they were the writer, maybe they were the director or the producer or something like that. Well, don't forget, there's also the person who did the storyboards or the music or the animatic. Mm-hmm. I know it's sometimes hard. But, you know, there's also the case that, you know, I guess, you know, if you can't, then I completely understand. But for people who can, it's like, well, then focus on the people who were a part of.
Focus on what works instead.
Yeah,
of
just exactly. Focus
it.
On what works and focus on the other people who did, you know, put their hard work into it and just focus on that.
Well said.
Yeah.
Focusing. That's another thing that seems to be a problem for so many people. They won't. Focus. And it's just like, well, I mean, before I write off a movie, I want to at least compliment the filmmakers who spent, you know, hours on end.
Some, for some, even years.
Yeah. for years, and to open up with dismal reviews or okay reviews, but not be admired until afterwards. I mean, you can even have, like you say, a mediocre story, but excellent animation that's award worthy, and you just have to say better luck next time. But I will applaud Pixar for doing that with Cars by deciding, hey, we got really great animation, but we're about to break our rule by not having a great story. So let's, you know, do what we did with Toy Story 2, have it be back, pushed back a year, and then we'll be ready to rock and roll.
Yeah. And again, I think that if something is delayed, that doesn't mean that, oh, we're just like,
yeah, there's
preventing
no
you from watching it.
Not all the time, but there are going to be times where it's like, hey, it just needs a little more rendering. We just overthought this way too much.
Yeah. I would say that if something is taking a long time, then let people take their time to finish it. I mean, even Shigeru Miyamoto had a quote when talking about something that, you know, was delayed again and eventually would come out later. He would say, a delayed game is eventually good, but a rush game is forever bad. So yeah, it's kind of like the same principle. If you're waiting on, I mean, literally Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was originally supposed to come out last year.
I believe it.
And you know, they delayed it for another year so that they can be able to finish what they were doing, and now it's going to be coming out in a few weeks, and a lot of people are really excited for it. So yeah, I think that if they're able to take another year to finish up everything, and if it's well worth it, then delays are a good thing.
Yes. Oh, but like you say, everyone always, like, it's like we're in clickbait mode now. They see one report and they instantly assume foul play. It's like, no. Just reread it. Don't read the attention getter headline. Read the actual thing and then come back.
Yeah. Or you got to love the clickbait articles of like, oh, here's an update of this project that was supposed to come out. Okay. According to rumors from some person, they say it's going to be coming out this time. Who knows when, but we know it's going to come out. They don't answer the question, but they're saying, oh, we got news that it's going to be coming out.
Politician move. Like, backtrack. Yeah. And we got this coming out.
Yeah, exactly. You got to love those.
You're not fooling anybody. Just say no. We'll stop asking. Shit.
Yeah. So any other movies that you want to bring up that means a lot to you?
So there were so many lists, and I got to get your take on some of these.
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Because there's ones like Land Before Time, as well as Brave Little Toaster and Song
of
the South.
I've talked about Land Before Time many years ago on my Sullivan Bluth Studios podcast with my good friend James, aka Himitude, and Matt Brunet, aka Animat. Fantastic film, by the way. It's one of my favorite that Don Bluth was able to do. Really heartwarming, very dark, very cinematic. I absolutely love it. Brave Little Toaster is definitely a film that was one that I actually saw a lot when I was a kid. There were some parts that frighten me. Yeah. There were actually some parts that did frighten me, though, but every time that I got back to it, I was always just engaged and just amazed by, you know, there's this, you know, animated film that was kind of like done in an independent studio that Disney distributed. Yeah. But it was something like I haven't seen at that point in time that was like really just dark and engaging. So, yeah, I really like Brave Little Toaster. And as for Song of the South, never seen it.
It's one of those where, I mean, like some of these other movies we mentioned, they're kind of a little grim. So you might only want to watch it with like a 12 plus crowd, while others is like, yeah, given the troubled history, what it's trying to say, the wrongs unfortunately outdo the good. And I'm not trying to be on a soapbox here, but it's just like Land Before Time I saw in pre-K and I surprisingly did not cry, but I think it messed me up.
Okay.
And my mother was furious. She's like, why aren't they showing you movies? They should be showing documentaries or nature. You know? I'm like, well, it's nature, but it ain't. Yeah, I don't have anything to do with. I can't even tell you what we were discussing that day. I was just like, why are we? Oh, you just want us to shut up and not talk? while we watch a movie that we don't really know what's going on. Okay. But yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to introduce a movie. And are you kind of shocked at how much isn't really even replayed all that much anymore? That people forget when Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network would play Disney or Fox movies, and vice versa. Disney would even play
it. It's all about distribution rights. That's the thing.
Whoever settled the copyright back then, and it blew your mind how they would come up with those ahead of time. But sometimes it wasn't always a sure thing. Sometimes they were literally repeated once and never shown again, and they were bigger hits at video stores, and you just couldn't believe it. You're like, really?
Yeah, I know.
Number one.
Yeah, I mean, can you believe that at some point before Cartoon Network came along, Nickelodeon was the one who aired the Looney Tunes cartoons?
Yes.
They aired Rocky and Bullwinkle, and they aired a lot of other old cartoons. But, you know, again, due to distribution rights and due to some parts of the contracts being expired, it goes over to whoever that they can be able to. Whoever gets it next. So, just kind of crazy about, you know, where it goes into, you know, who's going to own the distribution rights. Like, you know, the new Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon, Amazon. Or, you know, if you want to watch the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, you have to get a Peacock account. Or if you want to watch, you know, old Looney Tunes cartoons, you have to go to Cartoon Network. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy that you have to, like, jump, you know, hoops and bounds just so you can be able to watch your favorite stuff. But, you know, that's just the way it was. I mean, it's not like, you know, like back then, in which, like, if you wanted to, you know, tune in to watch Batman the Animated Series, but then, it's like Ren and Stimpy's on the air. And, oh, no, you know, here comes Goof Troop. It's like, you know, you had to choose one or the other. But, you know, nowadays, with the convenience of streaming, you can be able to just, like, you know, watch all of these, all, you know, like, you know, watch one episode and then switch over to the next one and switch over to the next one.
Yeah.
But but unfortunately, even streaming is not always reliable because they're removing a lot of stuff, whether it be, you know, to
so many
costs, or they don't have the rights to it anymore. It's kind of hard. And that's why you have to hold on to physical media or your old recordings VHS, because that's all you're going to have next.
That is all you get, man. That's all you get.
Ugh. Yeah, exactly. I remember listening to a podcast where they talked about how there's going to be some forms of media that's going to be forever preserved because of its cultural significance.
Yes.
But then there's going to be, like, the obscure stuff that is just, you know, something that maybe you grew up with and only you, and that's going to be faded away forever. And nobody else is going to remember it because there's no way, easy way of getting access to it.
And if it doesn't get taken away, then, you know, there's always going to be someone who just, it's just not in their right mind.
Yeah, like, it's kind of funny because, you know, unless, of course, if there's like a dedicated studio that's able to, you know, have like a massive crowdfunding campaign to bring rejuvenation to a lot of these old forgotten shows or movies, then, you know, unfortunately, they're just going to be left in the wayside. I remember a few months ago when there was like a Kickstarter to bring back the DVDs of Calamity Jane, which was, you know, 13 episode miniseries that aired in the late 90s. And, you know, pretty much nobody remembered it. And there was only like really old bootlegs of it. And all half of the episodes were missing. But then there was this Kickstarter that said, hey, we're going to bring it back. We're going to, like, bring back the quality of the DVDs of it. We're going to have, like, special behind the scenes stuff. And then people went crazy for it. They were able to meet their goal, and they were able to get this thing happening. That's good to show you that, you know, even the obscure things that people wanted, but, you know, major studios and major companies are going to be like, yeah, this is nothing that important. We can just, like, put it to the side. It's like, you know, let's just say Disney, for example. It's like, you know, that, you know, stuff like Snow White and Pinocchio and Little Mermaid and all that stuff, that's going to be preserved forever. But then, you know, then we go over to, like, some of the, you know, the old wartime cartoons like Saludos Amigos or Melody Time, or even like some of the more obscure, you know, stuff that, you know, kind of like underperformed, say like maybe, you know, Meet the Robinsons or something like that, is, you know, it's not going to be just as remembered. I even talked about this where, you know, a lot of the Disney films from the 2000s, you can't even find merchandise on, with the exception of Lilo and Stitch. Yeah, with the exception of Lilo and Stitch, it is very hard to find merchandise.
They lucked out on that one. I think it was the McDonald's Happy Meals. It just came in at that, right at the end of that, just back when people were even stealing SpongeBob merchandise on top of some Burger Kings that I would see, for whatever reason, stuff that was just kind of the losing animation. And back when we were first embracing DVD, and to have a show that everyone remembers as clear as day, and the studio has just refused to acknowledge it. It's almost like when Warner Brothers almost for longest time refused to embrace any of their PTEN, you know, before it was the WB shows, until B5 took off surprisingly well, to where then they were like, okay, I guess we'll distribute some of our other cult shows. But
yeah,
it is so weird how so many studios will start work with each other, but they won't. They're just not, if they're not fond of it, they want to kill it. And it's just like, well, people aren't just that ready to reject it just that suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, that's why MeTV, which is a television channel that came out a few years ago, became a massive success. It's like, you know, you missed all the shows that you grew up with back in the, you know, the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. and 70s. We're going to bring it back. And a lot of people tuned into it and they love it. So
I would see other parts of it, but it seemed like half their material was like on WGN. But yeah, mm-hmm. now they have all these other rights, so they're doing fun trivia with all these other classic shows. And yes. Yeah, the cartoon section is neat because they really do have some great animators just talking about some key stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I miss, like in like when you watch like you know, in Cartoon Network when they were first starting in the 90s, whenever they would air like a classic cartoon from MGM or from Warner Brothers or anything like that, they would always have like these people coming in and give you like fun facts. It's like, you know, yes. Did you know that Bob Clampett did this cartoon in 1949? Yeah, so I mean I'm sure that, you know, back then before the internet came along, this was like something that you would really want to tune into to get to learn all this stuff, because unless of course if you know were one of those people who went to the library and did all your research, and you know, if you were one of those people who like purchased the actual 8mm animated shorts that they showed in the theaters, and you would like look at it frame by frame, you didn't know any of this stuff. But now that we have the internet, that, you know, you're able to know everything. I mean, you're able to know about, you know, their filmographies. You're able to know about, you know, what other programs that they worked on and all that kind of stuff, that you know about facts that you would have never known otherwise.
Just all, that's the other thing, too, that we're having to cut through, is it's like, remind everyone, hey, you didn't always have IMDb at the tips of your fingers.
No.
Let alone look at it while you're watching the movie.
Pretty much.
You don't have that luxury.
But no, I mean, what we have now, I think that what we're looking into with, you know, what we have in terms of our availability of media. I mean, we have more accessibility to a lot of things than we've ever had before, but it's still kind of frustrating when you see a lot of people still not treating this stuff really seriously.
Yeah, or they use a lesser HD remaster. So it's like, okay, that's not Blu-ray quality, but that's an okay HD TV edit. But that's, we kind of expect better for what we're paying. You know?
Right, yeah.
For a movie that I want to rewatch and show to a kid or a cousin, you know, it's just like, it's not always going to cut the mustard. But like you say, you're happy that it's there versus not being there at all.
Yeah, it's kind of like a double-edged sword.
It's kind of, it's just oh man,
it's rough, but at the same time, you know, you take what you can get.
We get what we get, and then there's ones where it's like, yeah, I think we all need to simultaneously team up and report to customer support. I know you don't have the answer to this. Can we please talk to the head CEO? We'll be here. We got all day.
Yeah, or maybe like we'll give it to our respected person, and then you never hear back.
And they can't say because they want to actually work.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do I tell them everything they're doing is wrong and get fired, or do I?
Or do I just let them know we're giving it to the right people? Hopefully, you'll hear something back.
Hopefully. But
hopefully.
You're likely not going to hear anything back because they lost the rights and are trying to save face by showing a best of compilation, or they don't care about that, or they don't want to listen to what you think. And so we're just saying it nicely. Okay, we'll be in touch.
Yeah. I kind of had like a similar situation all the way back in 2003 when I wrote to Nickelodeon saying that I wanted to see Hey Arnold the Jungle Movie happen.
Fanmail was still a thing back then, guys.
And I remember that I didn't hear for several years until one day I got a letter from Craig Bartlett himself, and it was a drawing of Arnold, Helga, and Harold saying thanks supporting. And
it's as good as you're getting.
Yeah, at the time it was like the best that I could get because it wouldn't be for another decade in which we actually did get the Jungle Movie. I mean, it just goes to show you that fan demand, you know, again, this is one of the things that I really appreciate about what the fan base is able to do online is they're able to work hard to get the shows that they want to see come back. And, you know, fan demand, we got in the Jungle Movie. Fan demand, we were able to get another season of Kim Possible. A fan demand, we were able to...
Wild Thornberries.
Wild Thornberries, yeah. Exactly. We were able to get that too. So, yeah, I mean, I think that... You know, if the people are watching and listening, you know, their influences are just as massive and just as important as anything, like any executive who thinks that, oh, you know, these kids nowadays with their YouTubes and their Twitters and their Tumblrs and whatever.
Before they realize we're going to have to use YouTube as part of our marketing.
Pretty much.
It all matters, guys.
Yeah, it really does. It really does matter. If supporting the official release really does matter. You know, even as recently with going into Amphibia, where the creator, Matt Brawley, you know, he released a physical book about one of the characters' journal. And then people bought into it and they were really loving it. And then Disney was noticing and then they granted permission for more stuff in the future. Even with like, you know, all the fan participation, I mean, like there was an episode of Bob's Burgers called Brunch Squatch where the fans, they were a part of a contest and they drew these animation stills and it was a part of like the actual episode. It's kind of like a reanimation project that you see online, but put into an actual episode of the show.
Right.
And then you have these two guys who are huge fans of the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon from the 80s.
There you go.
They wanted to see the last episode, but it was never animated. They got the script and they were able to like get some clips of like the original actors and, you know, they got some stills of what the
I remember hearing about that. James Gapsu, who would win.
Yeah, and then they finally completed it, and then the creator of the Dungeons and Dragons game itself, his son, was like, oh, wow, I'm really impressed with what these fans were able to do. So it, you know, it kind of like became canon to like the series.
Yeah, totally. Did you ever follow the movie or TV version of Highlander?
No.
Okay, well, so there was a cartoon webisodes back when that was first becoming a thing, and the people loved it so much they did their own, they used archive voiceovers of the actors and made their own animation, completed the season basically. But it is interesting how it just comes in forms of everything. People just kind of play God, jury, and executioner at times with certain fandoms and certain stuff, and then it comes down to, well, there is an ending but the fans created it, or there is no ending unless you do a crowdfunder and talk to someone at Universal.
Yeah. And but sometimes even like crowdfunding to the original creators of your favorite projects doesn't automatically mean it's going to happen.
Sometimes like, they hate it. Sometimes they're like, no, I'm past it. I can't recreate that magic. You know?
Yeah. Or they could be like, I want to do this, but the studio will not let me.
Yeah. They have refusing to give it to me. I don't know if it's my tone of voice or if they're just being jerks.
Look no further than Maxwell Adams. He's been trying for over a decade to do a Billy and Mandy revival, but Cartoon Network keeps saying no. And
it's,
you know,
like
even,
they want it to be a classic but don't want any sequels or something.
Yeah,
it's
weird.
Streaming at one point. I know.
Yeah, I don't know why. Mr. Warburton was trying to pitch Galactic Kids Next Door for 15 years, and again, Cartoon Network said no. The Tremblay brothers, the creators of the SWATcast, did this crowdfunding campaign where they were able to raise enough money for a, you know, to make a 24-minute episode pitch to present over to different animation studios. And again, it's been almost a decade since that happened, and nothing has happened. And even like with Don Bluth, going back into him, you know, you remember that he did that crowdfunding campaign for that Dragon's Lair movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then he pitched it to various studios. They said no. Eventually Netflix said yes. But then they were doing this change where it was going to be live action and Ryan Reynolds was going to be Dirk the Daring. So
as if it's like, why did we even bother? You clearly had different ideas.
I mean, it can't be helped. I mean, it remember that people raise money for a pitch. They didn't raise money for the product itself. So they're helping with getting it out of, you know, out of limbo and into existence. And, you know, that's the thing with crowdfunding, is that it's a gamble. You know, sometimes you get what you want, other times you don't. But
right.
I mean, at least you can't say that, you know, they didn't try to pitch it to something that maybe you would have wanted to see, but
right.
It didn't always end up that way. And or maybe it did, and maybe it turned out to be fantastic. I mean, usually that stuff is, like I said, it's a gamble. You know, you could either have something really good or you can have something really bad. There's no in between.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when people were just like against, like, you know, crowdfunding and revivals and stuff like that, because they felt like they wanted to have things in a certain way that they remembered. But they also have to remember that a lot of things have changed since, you know, that particular movie or show came out. And so they have to generate towards that audience. Like we like Aaron and I, we talked about in the Jungle movie where it came out in 2017. But, you know, we knew that this was a project that was originally supposed to come out about 15 years prior. And it wasn't supposed to be like, oh, we're introducing this to a whole new generation of kids. No, this was supposed to be for the people who grew up with it in the 90s. And it was supposed to be a conclusion of when Arnold found his parents. But because it came out that late, now they have to kind of like be almost like a continuation, but at the same time be a restart for people who've never seen it the first time. It's complicated, you know? I mean, you either go all the way with like completely rebooting it from the ground up, like the DuckTales revival from 2017, or you can like have a continuation of it from where it left off, like say Animaniacs from Hulu, or you can just kind of rebuilt it from the ground up and have some elements that seem familiar, like the Rugrats revival on Paramount Plus.
They were so viable. Yep, they were everywhere.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, even in this industry, nostalgia makes money.
Totally. But
yeah, I think that you know, the new stuff, I think that people should also give a chance to as well. I mean, I remember when, you know, if a trailer for something doesn't seem appealing, then they'll be like, oh, I'm not going to go see it. But then the next person will be like, oh, you know, thanks for that you didn't see this new original project. Now expect to see a revival or a reboot or a sequel to a, you know, something that already happened. So I'm hoping you're happy about it. So it's complicated. You know, it's just really complicated. Yeah.
I'm feeling optimistic.
Yeah, you try to be optimistic. Yeah, it's kind of difficult sometimes to be optimistic when everybody has an opinion about something.
Yep.
Well, you know, like I know people have mixed reactions on, you know, various, you know, things. I mean, even I myself have mixed reactions on some things, and you know, I've gotten people saying, I can see where you're coming from. I've got people saying, well, I disagree, but I appreciate your opinion. Sometimes I've even gotten death threats. So
oh dear.
Yeah, I've literally gotten death threats. But yeah, sometimes, you know, when people post whatever that they can to state what they feel about it, you have to sometimes be careful. But again, it's all an opinion at the end of the day. If you enjoyed it, that's fine. Or if you didn't like it, again, that's fine.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, altogether, any other promotion you'd like to do before you take off?
Yeah. So again, if you are interested in checking out my work, you can see that I'm going to be showcasing my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/oldschoollane. I have various social media platforms that you can check out. I have a blog, which is oldschoollane.net. You can follow me on Facebook, which is facebook.com/oldschoollane. I'm on Twitter at @Patty_B_Miranda. You can check out my podcasts on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Audible.com, many places. If you're interested in checking out my podcast, I have several of them. There's Old School and Casual Chats, which is my main podcast where I talk about movies, TV shows, video games. I have interviews with various special guests. If you are interested in like a specific type of like movie series or certain movie companies, then I've done tons of them. There's again, as we mentioned throughout the podcast, there's PixMix where I talk about Pixar films, Dream Machine where I talk about DreamWorks films, the Roald Dahl Retrospective where I talked about adaptations based off of Roald Dahl's books. There's also Journey to the Blue Sky where I cover Blue Sky Studios films. And then there's In Search of the Crystal Skull, where I talk about films that are rated 60 to 79% on Rotten Tomatoes. As of the making of this, I just posted up a new episode of Casual Chats where I interviewed Rebecca Boza, who you may know as Rebecca Rose on YouTube, where she did analytical videos on stuff such as Steven Universe and Amphibia and The Owl House. And we talked about her time doing those videos and even when she became a production assistant on The Owl House. And as mentioned before, on Monday, which is going to be Memorial Day, we're going to be having a podcast dedicated to Quest for Camelot. So stay tuned
for
that.
There we go.
Yeah, it is a massive party. Absolutely.
Anytime, anywhere. It's a party.
Yeah. And once again, if you are in the Atlanta area and you're going to be over at the Georgia Convention Center, please come over to MomoCon and see my panel, which is writing analytical essays on media. It's going to be at room 404. My panel is going to be at, let's see, it's going to be on Sunday, May 28th at 8:30 a.m.
Stellar. Okay. Well, thanks again for just revisiting history with us.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jackpot.